Hello and welcome to a new episode of If I Speak, the show for yappers, gossips and perennial overthinkers. I'm joined by my co-pilot, my comrade, the CEO of Disordered Attachment Inc., Moya Lothian-McLean. Moya, how the hell are you?
It's actually disorganized attachment, Ash. You know how I am. I'm overthinking. I'm overthinking again.
President of the Rumination Nation. I mean, what have your headlines been? It's been a little while since me and you have had a chance to chat.
The headlines that are really stressing me out, I can't talk about. And it's not just the things that I've mentioned to you. There's other stuff going on. All I will say is some men are very bitter and they think they're not bitchy. Some of the biggest bitches I know are men, and they want to bring you down and they want to see you fail, but you shall not topple me. Roads shall not fall this time. That's one thing I will say. I want to know what you've been up to. Where have you been gallivanting off to?
Oh, well, I went on my first completely work-free holiday for so long. So when I say a work-free holiday, I mean a work-free holiday where I didn't check Slack, where I wasn't writing something, where I wasn't doing anything remote. I genuinely was not working. And it was going to Spain for my best friend's wedding, which, by the way, was fucking magical. Like, it's so much more fun when your friend gets married rather than you getting married, because like I remember particularly before the ceremony just being so anxious, and like everyone was staring at me in this completely crazy way, and I was like, I don't know, like, this is why people elope, like I'm not sure if I could do this with like everyone looking at me. And you don't have that emotion when it's your best friend, because you're the one doing the crazy staring. You're the one doing the crazy stare where you're like, oh my God, you're the most beautiful thing I've ever seen in my whole life. So it was completely gorgeous. At the wedding, definitely ran into some If I Speak special ones, which was great. So I was be chatting to people and they'd be like, you better not put this in your stupid little podcast. And you know what? I have put it in my stupid little podcast, Owen Hurley. So that was really, really fun.
I have an update. I have an update from a special one.
Oh, what?
It's a good update. Those of you may remember the special one who wanted to fake their own death. Met the special one who was going to fake their own death. And they did not fake their own death. And they said, thank you very much for the advice. And I can confirm that they are very interesting and engaging in real life. And they don't need smelly boys to prove that.
You know what? I knew they were going to be interesting and engaging. Like, of all the special ones, it's not like I read that dilemma and I was like, well, you're going to be really boring. I was like, nah, bitch, you're creative as fuck. Like, if anything, too much imagination. But yeah, the one thing about the wedding, which was a bit like, mwah, mwah, is that, thank God, after the celebrations, because it's an Irish wedding, right? So there's 2 days, there's day one and day two. After all the celebrations of day one, my best friend, the bride, broke her foot.
No.
Which was not ideal. Yeah. And like, she sent me the x-ray yesterday and it's like a proper, proper break. So it really is like something old, something new, something badly fractured and possibly displaced, something blue.
Is that a good omen?
So the day two, she was wearing her beautiful outfit and dress and one really high heel and one flip-flop and then had patched the foot with ice. So it didn't stop her.
Oh.
Did not stop her.
I'd be bummed out. I'm not gonna lie. I know. It's a bum out. I'm not gonna lie. Breaking a foot. Is there a honeymoon? Will they be going on a honeymoon with the broken foot?
I think they're gonna have to like do some more scans than that. But like, and again, I think this is sort of a testament to like when you are determined that you're going to have a good time and something's going to be really special, you can like push through to a crazy extent. Mm. So, you know, there she was with her like foot propped up and like her crutches at this like, you know, this celebration. And I was just like, baby, are you all right? And she's like, nothing is going to ruin my special weekend. And you know what? Like, fair fucking play to her. Like, fair fucking play. So yeah, I'm so delighted for them. And I don't know if you get this, but like, we always talk about vicarious pleasures and vicarious happiness as though it's sort of like a bit weird or creepy or parasocial, but I think it was one of those times where I was like, oh, your happiness is so intrinsic to my happiness. Seeing you be happy at this point has just flooded my body with happiness. And yeah, it felt really special. So those were my headlines.
I do get that. When I see my friends happy, there is a rush of like love and contentment, and it distracts me from like my own trivial, silly little problems. Cause like, oh, this is what really matters. You know, seeing the people you love most in the world find joy, whether that's romantically, platonically, or just something they're doing, being around them just literally lifts my spirits to an unheard of degree. God, friends are great. Friends are so great.
Friends are so great.
I've got some questions to ask you.
Hit me.
Let's go with the first one, which kind of fits in nicely. When do you feel most vulnerable?
Getting a cervical smear.
I just had mine again.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, I got that. Got those abnormal cells, haven't I? The HPV vaccine does fuck all. Does fuck all.
Don't worry. Like, with time, those abnormal cells can just go away.
That's what they say. But until that happens, then it's every 6 months getting. And also, I was very anxious this week. So I don't really care talking about openly about this. I didn't realize that talking about HPV was meant to be a thing. Like, everyone has HPV. I'm sorry to say, you have a strain of HPV. And if you don't think you don't have it, you probably do.
80% of people will have it at some point.
Literally. But I was quite anxious. And normally I can do my deep yoga breathing and relax during a smear, and they tell me I'm a good little girl and I've, you know, got a low cervix, whatever the fuck it is. This time I was tense, and it was a guy doing it, which shouldn't really matter. And I think on a theoretical level didn't, but something in my body was like, get your hands away from me.
No, it is anxiety inducing. Like, I had a guy fit my coil. I've got a hormonal coil, and it was, you know, I didn't have a choice. Like, it was a really busy clinic. It was a real like, now or never kind of thing. I'd book the appointment, and I was trying to be really cool about it, but I was just like, no, this does freak me out, actually. Like, this does freak me out a bit. So anyway, that's when I feel most vulnerable, when the feet go in them stirrups. I'm like, oh Lord Jesus.
Yeah, God, that is a literal physical and emotional vulnerability. Okay, second question. Maybe is this Spanish themed? I don't think so, but favorite pastry.
Ooh, favorite pastry. Okay, it has to be savory for me. I am savory over sweet all day. And when it comes to my ideal pastry experience, I suppose I would go for something which is more robust than it is flaky. Even though I do love like a burek, you know, I love something with those layers of phyllo. Ultimately, it's going to have to be something a bit more robust. And so I come back to the humble but mighty samosa.
Any flavors in particular?
I love a meat samosa. I love a veggie samosa. But whenever I'm having a samosa, and this is going to absolutely disgust my ancestors, I want it dipped in ketchup.
Wow.
Yeah.
You I love it dipped in ketchup. So British. That is like the classic like meeting of worlds. Samosa dipped in ketchup. Good Lord.
It's actually fusion cuisine.
Yeah, that is fusion cuisine. Please. You're fusing. I'm not sure whether it should be a fusion. It's a kind of fusion where you're like, oh, this is going to destroy the world. It's fusion though. Rather than like, rather than a delicious fusion. Okay, last one. Last thing you watched on a TV or plane screen?
Oh, that's super easy. Rewatching Game of Thrones with my husband and my housemate. And it's really fun because obviously we've watched it like, you know, before, but now we get to like shit talk throughout, which is my favorite activity, by the way. Like, you know, you ask me when I feel most vulnerable. Like, if you're going to ask me when I feel most content, it's watching something familiar with husband and housemate and shit talking.
Oh God, that's so nice. That's just such a nice, image. I want to live in a house with a husband and a housemate.
Well, before you move to Glasgow, like, come over and come ready to talk shit about Lord of the Rings.
To be fair, in Glasgow, I'm moving in with a very old friend who I think would be very up for rewatching and shit talking, and is actually like the perfect kind of homemaking housemate. So I'm quite excited about the opportunities offered for sitting and shit talking familiar stuff.
You know what? Maybe next week we do a homemaking special, because I have actually been thinking about this a lot, about what does it take to create a home and a sense of home. So maybe next episode.
That's a great idea, Ash. A homemaking special is when you're an itinerant renter.
Yeah.
Okay, bank that.
All right, so this week we have a mystery question. Now, for those unfamiliar with the concept of a mystery question, our producer, Chal, our shadow director, the power behind the throne, dings me a mystery question, and we are contractually obliged to chew over it like dogs on a pizzle stick. So, Chal, hit me. My phone is on loud. Ooh. Okay.
Isn't it dinging?
Question from Chal.
Oh, wait, is it dinged? It's dinged. Okay, sorry, I didn't even hear the ding. It was a quiet ding.
It dinged. Has our newfound fluency in therapy language made our lives better? Ah, oh, this is such a good one.
I might just cry. I'm going to cry today. I can feel it in my bones.
Oh,
I need a
no,
big cry.
But this is a safe space for crying. This is absolutely a safe space for crying.
Do you want to kick off?
Yeah, I mean, so I really swing between the two extremes on this one. And it depends entirely who I'm talking to and what I'm trying to persuade them of. So when it comes to my mum, this is really essential context. My mum was a social worker. So like all social workers I know everywhere, she's like, yes, for other people, therapy. For myself, absolutely not. Like every social worker I know is like, other people need counselling. I don't need it and I would never need it. And so she has this sort of skepticism towards it, which I think sometimes can inhibit her from accessing her own emotions because she's such a Taurus, all right? She's the most Taurus to have ever Taurus on this planet. Like when it comes to things being like really, really difficult, she's like, I've just got to like put my hooves on the ground and like keep trucking forward. Like that's very much her approach. And so when I'm sort of saying, hey, well, maybe you can process some of this experience and access some of these emotions and let them move through you and that'll be good for you. She's like, I think the fuck not. So when I'm speaking to her, obviously, like I'm a big proponent of not just, hey, maybe do some therapy, but also maybe some of these therapeutic models for understanding your emotions and how your emotions, you know, reside in your body or get stuck in your body. I'm a real advocate for that. And that's because I'm coming up against a very, very stubborn brick wall. But I think when it comes to a form of therapy language where the language and like the vocabulary is being mistaken for actual insight, and awareness is a way of actually not changing your actions or even creating greater permission for behaviors which are annoying or actively detrimental to other people. That's where I'm like, oh, I don't really like what therapy language has done to our culture and has done for our way of interacting with people. Like I think sometimes it can take us further away from authentically experiencing or understanding ourselves and the people around us. So those are my two completely contradictory feelings and thoughts about it. And maybe through this conversation, I can arrive at some kind of resolution because that's called dialectics, baby. What do you reckon, Moya?
Well, I think you've hit upon something there anyway, which is you say these are my two totally contradicting things, as if you can't hold two contradictory thoughts at the same time. And, you know, that in the middle is where the nuance and maybe a something like a truth actually lies. I think the problem with our adoption of therapy language is also fits in that. Like it's gone mainstream. So these are terms that have been very diluted. I use them, you know, as synonyms for something else. I'm talking about my attachment theory all the fucking time and like talking about, I don't know. I'm trying to think about my experiences in talking therapy and things like the drama triangle and these explanations again and again and again. But we use them as sort of like binary. This is the one thing that explains this one thing. And that's the only way I can understand myself or through the world and in almost a very deterministic way. Whereas it also depends on the therapy framework. Like, are we talking about talking therapy? Are we talking about things like somatic therapy, which is different? CBT, like what? I think we're referring to talking therapy language here and the certain register that we speak in when you talk about like traumas and responses and things like that. And I don't know. I think there's a tendency online, particularly because it tends to be in online spaces, that drips into IRL, which is just to boil things down and pathologize so that it's a one explanation for one problem, which is not how the world works at all. Like I think I often think about this because I've got lots of friends, and I've said this before, in recovery for addiction. And the addiction framework is a particular framework. If you subscribe to it, you have to subscribe to it kind of fully in order to get the benefits out of it. And it might not even be like, I've got friends who are in like sex and love addiction recovery. And that's more of a sticky one than alcoholism or, you know, narcotic dependence, because people don't recognize it the same way. And it's like, is it the right thing to even call this addiction, the what you're experiencing? Does it even matter though, when the practical therapy that they're going through is actively in helping their lives? So that's the way I think about therapy. It's like, what is the best framework right now to try and help me with my problems? And it might be that it's talking therapy. It might be it's CBT. It might be doing like the 12 steps, even if I don't have a certain type form of addiction. It's like, how do you find a framework that helps you manage your things that you struggle with more and helps you be more content in life and more whole as a person? And that, I think that's really hard as well, because it gets to the other bit of therapy language that I find so difficult. I've got lots to say on this, so I'll try and keep it brief and try and like streamline it. But I think often, and I suffer from this a lot, we over-intellectualize what's happening to us because we want to, especially if you're someone who can account for themselves very easy, if you can articulate yourself and account for what's happening, then you can say, this is X and this is Y and this is this. And talk about therapy, and you can create a narrative that sounds really good and really accurate. And guess what? It might be fucking wrong and it might do nothing to help you. Often I'll go over a problem in my head and I'll be able to like pick apart exactly how I'm thinking, feeling, and come up with an explanation for it. And it doesn't change how I'm feeling. It doesn't change it. And there's a gap there between the talking I'm doing and the narrative I'm applying, the therapy techniques, and actual practical sort of therapeutic maybe methods that I could be using to help me more. And so I think when we talk about therapy language, it's like the difference between language and action. If the language doesn't translate to like actual action that is somehow addressing the problem you have identified, then is it making our lives better? Or is it just another way to complicate and confuse ourselves a lot of the time? You know, you say, but it could be this, but it could be that. And then I have this explanation. And I'll finish up this little segment, even though I have lots more to say, by talking about a person. Actually, no, there's people who I have known who I think have a very unwell and who have, I would say, recently done me quite a disrespectful injury, a moral injury, a moral injury, I will say. Is that the right word? I'm not sure.
Yeah, you know what? And an injury to one is an injury to all on this podcast. Like, we truly have, like...
They've tried to do me damage. Yeah. They've tried to do me damage, and they have done it out of a sense of hurt feelings and a bruised ego, is what I would say. And the way they accounted for why they were doing this damage was through therapy speak, which I can't get into the problem or why they've done this or how they said talked about it, because it would mean going into a lot of dirty laundry. And unlike them, I'm not about to blow up their spot. Okay. I'm not about to blow up their spot, but they are someone who relies on this idea constantly. If you call them out and you say, I don't think this is healthy, I don't think that you are behaving in a well manner, and I'm not sure the way that you're dealing with it is good for you. And that's why I think, you know, we should probably have separate lives. Then they will say, I'm in therapy. Great, you're in therapy. What does that mean when you lie to yourself compulsively and other people around you? What does that mean when you're in therapy and you can say all these things, but it actually is so divorced from your actions and the way that you behave to other people? It's literally like, I don't know, a fantasy. What does it mean when you can spin a fantasy about yourself and why you're doing the things you're doing? And like, how does therapy help then? How does therapy language help? It just means you confuse and bamboozle the people you're talking to, and it takes longer for them to pick through and look at the reality of the situation versus what you're telling them. And therapy language has not helped this person in any way, shape or form. It has made them sicker. It has just given them a buffer and a stall. It's a stalling tactic. And what they really need is, like, I would say, sort of the addictive framework approach, which is this horrible, practical, full-on therapy where you literally have to sit down and confront yourself first of all. Because I think therapy can be great. Talking therapy is amazing as a start to like get out what you're feeling and this raw id. But like, I've had therapists who literally will just sit there and listen to me and just nod along. And it's like, no, I'm so good at talking about myself, but that doesn't mean I'm good at actually helping myself. Like, I need to be confronted with stuff. And I think talking therapy and therapy language allows you to account for yourself in ways that might not always be beneficial to your own growth?
So I think there's a difference between therapy language and therapy practice, right? Mm. And the question from Chow very much was about therapy language. And the important thing about that is that that is language which is abstracted from practice and is completely decontextualized from a therapist even, right? It's people who are taking language and concepts and using them in ways which are sometimes useful and also sometimes not, right? And so you're kind of having to pick through, like, is that abstraction of language from context actually making society better? I think ultimately, my answer to that is no. And the reason why is because it's about labels and it's about identity and it's about saying, well, I'm like this in a way which is fixed and unchanging, rather than, oh, I've realized that this behavior which I felt I lacked control over stems from these things, and I'm going to actively change some things about how I live my life or the context that I put myself in so that the connection between this cause and this effect is severed or broken or troubled, or I have capacity to control and regulate my emotions and behavior, right? The problem is that, like, you know, me and you have talked about this a lot. In fact, one of the very, very first pieces of content that me and you did over influencer culture was about this, is the obsession with identity and how that's connected to social media. Social media is an exercise in branding. You have to attach recognizable labels to yourself all the time for you to be legible to other people within that context. And therapy language very much fits in with that. Like, and I understand the temptation, and I'm not gonna sit here and pretend that I'm better than everybody else. Like, I don't self-brand on social media. Nope, have developed a whole career out of it. Thank you very much. But I think that there is a narcissism and an inwardness and, quite frankly, something which is deeply antisocial about the way in which these concepts and labels are deployed. It's very much, I'm this, right? I'm this. These are the parameters of interacting with me because I am this. And you don't even think about it as a snapshot, rather than like, oh, you know, right now I'm like this. It's very much fixed, and it's almost like saying, you know, I am the sun and you are all planets and you will orbit me in this way. You know what, guess what, like, everyone is their own sun, right? And functions as planets to other people. We exist in the context. You didn't just fall out of a coconut tree. You exist in a system of people. And to sort of like loop round to the sort of like language versus practice distinction, there are also different kinds of talking therapy. I mean, just to make the super obvious point, you know, you have existential psychotherapy, you have psychoanalysis, and you also have systemic models of therapy where you literally bring in the other people with you because you're looking at how you function as a social system, whether that's friends or relationships or family, or, you know, these things all in context with each other. And the idea is you bring everybody in because it's not about these individual labels. It's about identifying the dynamics that you are all responsible for creating. And while I don't have personal experience of doing systemic family therapy, because like I said, good luck bringing a social worker mother into a therapy room, right? Good fucking luck. She's like, I'm going to remove all your kids. No, joking. She wouldn't do that willy-nilly. But like, I don't have any experience of that, but there's something about the systemic nature of it and the fact that it isn't about labels. That's not about labels. It's about how we interact with each other. And that being the focus that I've got more time for. And with my own experiences of therapy, I think I've been quite lucky, which is I've worked with therapists who are very, you know, and I think it's because going into therapy, I was like, this is what I have time for and this is what I don't have time for, right? Like, please do not try and fit labels around me because I will just, I that does not fit with my value system. It's not that it doesn't connect with my sense of self. It's that I'm scared it will make me too interested in myself. So instead, we have talked about emotional states and we've talked about triggers and we've talked about dynamics. And for me, that's just been so much more useful rather than a sort of trying to use, you know, diagnostic labels as though it's like, you know, for me, it's like, it's an elevation of what is like often navel gazing. Not always, but often navel gazing. And it's funny that you talked about the addiction model, because like also one of the things about the practice of addiction treatment is to not be so interested in yourself. Mm. And an encouragement towards like outwardness, because saying like, okay, well, you're going to live in your own rumination. It's like, well, no, that's bad. Like that's living in your own rumination is one of the things which drives your compulsive behavior, whether it's sex and relationships or alcohol and narcotics. Again, that's so different from therapy language. But I would be remiss if I didn't point out, Moya, that you have sometimes used therapeutic language in relation to yourself when it comes to attachment styles. So disorganized attachment, that's been your sort of, and this is an open question. This isn't a like, fuck you, Moya. It's a like genuine question. What about that language has felt useful to you?
This is why I think we shouldn't throw the baby out of the bathwater. And did I say that I don't think it's made society better? Because if I did, I want to go back on that, because I'm thinking more about the impact it's had on therapy language has had sort of through osmosis on my family and the whole idea of like mental health, which I think goes hand in hand. And I would say I would take any injury by some random person to me, any insult, I would take that. I would absorb that in exchange. God, I'm about to cry. In exchange for like the benefits it's brought to my family. To see them like opening up and being able to give names to things just because of like the mainstream impact of therapy language is worth so much more to me than anything, any like troll man can try and do to me using the weaponization of therapy language. I think very emotional. When I was thinking about my family being like, you know what, it's all worth it, it's all the annoying people online, like let's look at the bigger picture here, because I do think we have a tendency to focus in on, well, I have a tendency, I can't speak for you, to focus thing on the things that annoy us and turn that into like the worst of society, the dregs of society, we're all going to the dogs. But like when I think about it, yeah, therapy language has caused great evil in this world. Great affronts have been made thanks to therapy language. But also like the fact that like my mum and my aunts and, you know, other members of my family can discuss things and also approach things in a way that just wouldn't have been considered 10, 20 years ago about themselves, about people they love. Like that is just worth, that's priceless. That's priceless to me. So I've actually gone on 180. I'm like, maybe therapy language, I will take it. This is the nuance that I'm talking about. And when you say like, why are these things useful to me? I think because they're useful to everyone. The same reason they're useful to lots of people, they feel like a shorthand for summing up complex emotions, feelings, reactions that you might not be able to articulate bit by bit. And when you find them bundled together in a helpful little package, that's what we're attracted to. Cause it's like, that's why we like labels, because it bundles in all the mess and complexity of being a human and puts us in a little box so you can know instantly. I was talking to someone recently and I was saying, I can't categorize you. And they were like, why does everyone want to categorize each other? I don't understand. And for me, it's almost a safety, because it's like I know where to put you in my mind, and I know how to approach you, and I know how to talk to you. And when you can't categorize someone, it's a lot more difficult, because you then have to trust that you're going to have the time to like work them out rather and be able to tailor yourself to meet their needs. I think that's something I'm always trying to do, tailor to meet other people's needs. Whether I'm effective at that, I don't know. And when it comes to like saying I have a disorganized attachment or I have this and that, it's mostly because the bundle of traits that those things describe are things that I find validation in. I find myself seen in that, and it's an easier way to sort of talk about something I'm going through than just being like, yeah, I can't stop fucking ruminating about this silly thing that's happened that really won't have like a long-term bearing on my life beyond the fact that it happened and I feel really bad about it because of, you know, my attachment, blah, 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 blah. But again, all these things can be changed. All these things can be worked on. in some ways. I think the thing that therapy language sometimes misses is, as I said, we can explain ourselves till the cows come home through language, but you might still have the physical reactions. And it's I think what therapy and what therapy techniques are meant to do is not deny those reactions. It's not about suppressing those reactions. It's about knowing that they will come and how to keep the scaffolding up until you feel okay again, until you feel regulated again. Like, it might be a thing that I never experience a point where I'm like not dysregulated when, you know, someone doesn't fucking text me or whatever. But I can deal with the reaction to that and know that it will pass. And that might lessen with time and keep just going out and doing the thing. Like, I had a friend recently who went through something very serious, and it happens every now and then, this pattern. And they know now, like, when they're in it, you think that it's going to last forever. But if you have the scaffolding around you and like, okay, I'm going to go to the gym, I'm going to go for like, I like going on buses for a long period to make me calm down. I need to go and see like these particular people because that makes me calmer. When you finally get out of it, like, your life will still be intact around you rather than just burning it all down because you're in a headspace where that seems the only viable option. I think that's the difference with like the benefits of therapy language, understanding what is happening, even if you still feel it.
Yeah, I suppose I really hear you, and I don't want to dismiss the usefulness of it. And I think, you know, part of it may well be that I've absorbed like some of my mum's, you know, skepticism, and, you know, because she is such a huge model for me in terms of like, you know, she's got an enormous capacity for resilience and emotional self-regulation. And that's definitely something that I've absorbed, to the point where my partner was just like, yeah, you're the most controlled person I know. And that's not always a good thing. And he's completely right in that. But I guess I'm also worried about pathologizing normal human behavior. And that doesn't mean that I think that like everything is fine and you know, just do whatever you want because, hey, it's human. But I'm worried about saying what is ideal and what is normal is the exact same thing, because, you know, being like spun out because, you know, someone hasn't texted you or someone has you know, behaved in such a way that's made you feel like undermined or disrespected, or someone has like actively been out to upset you. I mean, there are your ideal responses to that, but then there are also your just normal ones where you're like, no, I am going to have a big cry, or like, no, this has shaken me up and I feel very like socially anxious, or like, no, I do feel very angry at this person. And the reason why I'm bringing it up is because this was actually something that I was discussing in therapy the other week, which was, I've very often felt that I can't just be angry, that I've learned to have to really, really, really control my anger because the negative consequences of me being angry will be different from what they are for other people, because, you know, of what my job is, and that like it'll become attached to me as being like an angry brown woman, and I can't just be angry. And I was talking about an example where like I was just angry at someone who'd like really, really, really like set out to needle me, and like, you know, we're at a party and they were annoyed at me about something, and I was like, hey, I just don't really want to talk to you about this, and rather than just being like, okay, fine, and like, what, you know, whatever, was like, okay, well, I think you're a vacuous cunt, so I was like, okay, well, let's just fucking have a fight then, let's just fucking go for it. And then they started crying, it was a whole thing, and then people were like talking about it and like, you know, like making out that I'd been like behaving in such an unacceptable way. And I was talking about this to my therapist, and I was just like, you know, that was years and years ago, but it very much stuck with me that that is the cost of me being angry, which is that, you know, I'm going to see people like subtweeting about it, and I'm going to see people like, you know, turning it into this like big thing. And I was like, no, you called me a cunt, and like, you can't then just like go off and cry. Like, that's a provocation. And I was provoked. Like,
sorry, they called you a vacuous cunt.
They called me a vacuous cunt.
What did you do? Yeah, tell us the story. Tell this story.
Oh my God. Okay. So what happened was that like, I was at this party, and this person had dated a very good friend of mine. And me and this very good friend had like fallen out of contact. And that was totally on me, and I should have handled it differently. But then they came up to me and they were like, oh, you really upset them. And I was like, okay, but this should be up to them to talk to me and not you. Like, you know, they're like, but why did you behave this way? Why did you behave this way? And I was like, I literally don't owe you an explanation. Like, I owe them an explanation. And if they're upset with me, they should talk to me. But I'm not having it out with you. And then they were like, well, you're a vacuous cunt, just like straight out. And like, you know, I was at a party. So like, obviously, like, you know, had been imbibing, put it that way. So I like threw my, like, you know, my backpack down and they took my earrings out. And I was like, if you want to go, let's fucking go. And then they like scurried off into the corner and they were crying. They were like surrounded by loads of people. And there was definitely, I feel there was a very, very strong racial dimension to it.
They cried white. Just because you said, let's fight. You didn't even fight them.
I didn't even fight them.
Listen.
I very strongly feel that there was like a racial dimension to it because like, they're white, I'm not. They start crying, they're surrounded by people. And then it's like, oh, like Ash is this, Ash is that. Like, and you know, saw like subtweets about it like years later. And like, you know, did I behave in a way which was like my most mature and self-controlled? No, but like you called me a vacuous cunt. Like, I'm sorry. Like, not to be like where I grew up, but seriously, where I grew up, you just expect to get boxed in the mouth for that. You don't talk to someone like that unless you're up for being boxed in the mouth. That's just what I feel. But I was talking to my therapist about it. And I was saying like, the lesson I learned from that is that I can't be angry. I cannot be angry in the way that other people are angry because it'll be attached to my name and it'll be attached to my reputation in a way that it's just not going to for other people. And that's to do with race and that's to do with my job and it's to do with all these things. Like, I don't have the same freedoms to be emotionally unregulated like other people. And my therapist was like, yeah, you know, but maybe, you know, understanding what was the trigger for you, da, da, da. I was like, the trigger was someone calling me a vacuous cunt. Like, it's not that deep. Like, that was the trigger. And my therapist was like, oh, but like, you know, maybe it would have been good to do some I sentences. Like, you know, I feel this way, I feel that way. And I was like, okay, the I sentence there is, I feel like I want to punch you in the mouth. Like, and this is the thing about ideal versus normal. Ideally, I'd have done the I sentences and talked about my emotions. What is normal is to say, here's the fucking line and you have fucking crossed it. Like, you have been a habitual line stepper, to quote Dave Chappelle. You have Charlie Murphy'd all over my emotional couch. And I it's now time to drag you out. And I suppose the person who really, you know, taught me the lesson about not mistaking what is ideal for what is normal is actually my best friend who got married, who is just my like emotional North Star. Like, she's taught me so much, and I don't know, I'll forever feel a sense of gratitude towards her for that. And it's because, you know, there are times where she's been wronged and she said, okay, here's the ideal way to react, but I'm actively choosing not to do that. I'm actively choosing not to do the ideal thing because this person has to fucking know that they cross the line of, you know, what is a tolerable level of disrespect, right? This is no longer a tolerable level of disrespect. And so, yeah, I know that this is getting away from the idea of therapeutic language, and this is much more to do with what is presented as ideal within a therapeutic context. Obviously, we should always aim for the ideal. We should always aim for the ideal. Or bear in mind that there is an ideal, right? You should know that there is an ideal, but sometimes you're going to make a choice to turn away from that, and that's okay.
Yeah, I also think the weight of the ideal is so crushing. It's like, oh, you have to be this, you have to be that, and then sometimes you're like, well, I'm not that, so I may as well fuck it. I may as well say fuck it and go low. But every time I've gone low, I have regretted it. I have to say, every time I've gone literally against the instinct of like, this is healthy behavior, this is unhealthy behavior, and I've chosen the unhealthy behavior, then in the long run, it has caused a lot of problems. So that's all I will say when we're talking about this. It's
oh yeah, and I'm not an advocate for emotionally dysregulated behavior. And like I said, the lesson I learned from that is I don't get to be angry like other people. Like, yeah. I just don't get to.
Yeah, I do think it comes back to this idea of like, you will experience that emotional dysregulation. You will experience these things. The question is your therapeutic language, as you say, a therapeutic practice? Is it something that's helping you just accept those emotions and deal with them rather than repressing them? Or is it something where you're using it to like over-intellectualize and pathologize very normal human emotions to the degree where you're treating yourself like you're an alien for feeling things? And I think maybe that's the line, but who knows?
Whatever people find genuinely helpful, I'm not here to yuck on anyone's yum. Even though as a podcaster, it's literally my job. But I don't wanna yuck anyone's yum. But the thing that I would consider or encourage people to consider is what actually is helpful. Like, is it just about something that's being helpful to yourself, or is it about being helpful within a wider social context, which includes other people? And I'd encourage people to opt for the latter.
Yeah, I think the thing that's most helpful for me often is just seeing my friends and being reminded of the love that I have for them and that they have for me, and that connection. When you, it's crazy, when you are on your own, moping, self-obsessing, just barely trying to keep the emotional lights on, and then you see your friends and you're just rejuvenated by this love and care, and it's like, wow, the world isn't terrible, and you know what, like, I'll survive this one very small minor thing that's happened to me, or even this big large thing that's happened to me. And as you always say, Ash, it comes down to human connection. We're having human connection with other people, and that perhaps is the most healing thing of all. But yeah, therapy language, where do we finally stand? Is it overall net good, overall net bad?
I'm pro therapeutic practice. I think I'm anti therapeutic language.
I think I have to just edge 58-42. Is that what it was eventually? I think I'm just about pro-therapeutic language because I think it can be a gateway to the therapeutic practice, and I will take the benefits that that has afforded people that I love and people I don't know over even the cons, which is it's made a lot of annoying people 10 times more irritating. Okay.
Do you want to read a dilemma?
Yeah, go on.
This is our regular segment, I'm in big trouble. If you are in big trouble and you have a problem which we couldn't possibly make anyone worse, you know what to do. Email us at ifispeak@navaramedia.com. That's ifispeak@navaramedia.com. So Moya, take it away with our first problem from a very special one.
Dear Moya and Ash, I hope you're both having a wonderful summer, and thank you for this podcast. It's so thoughtful and has provided me with a lot of comfort through some difficult times. You and me both, bud. I was hoping you might be able to advise me on how to deal with an awkward family situation.
Fake your own death.
No. For context, I'm a guy with three younger sisters that are all really close with each other and have a lovely relationship. I also live in Cornwall, about 5 hours away from my parents and siblings. Please don't come for me, Ash. I promise not everyone here is a bellend. I moved to Cornwall with my boyfriend 10 years ago for university, and since then I found that my sisters and I have become quite distant. My youngest two sisters speak to me occasionally, and although I'd love to be closer to them, I feel like we have a pretty comfortable relationship when I come up to London to visit them, and both parties put in reasonable effort to maintain the relationship. The youngest one has even moved down to Cornwall a few months ago studying medicine and sees us regularly now. Sadly, the oldest of my sisters rarely speaks with me. And even when I reach out to ask how she's doing, I feel the conversation tends to get shut down quickly. Since leaving London, she's gradually become colder and more difficult to talk to. Although she's civil enough when I've come to visit for Christmas, even though it feels like I'm a work colleague. I think it's leaving for London, because they go on to say, whenever my boyfriend and I are back in London, she dislikes me spending time with him and his family. I think we're held to different standards to herself, all my other family members and their partners, all heterosexual. So able to visit their partners and friends without any rude comments being made. I feel everything I do annoys her, from my job, where I live, or even how I speak. Although my sister is a very progressive person who has similar views to me, I'm starting to feel though that there may be a touch of homophobia directed towards me and my partner. I'm struggling to know the best way to address this with her. Since coming out to her, our relationship hasn't been the same. It could be that she just doesn't like me as a person, and I may be reading too much into the reasons for her coldness. I want to have a frank conversation with her as we're going on a family holiday soon, but she's quite a headstrong, reactionary person. I feel stuck as to how I should approach this without breaking down whatever is left of our relationship or making her feel accused of something she's been quite vocally against on her social media. She's pretty stubborn about being in the right, and I think it could be a real delicate challenge to get through to her about the way my partner and I feel. I'm also conscious of upsetting my family whilst away with them, as it's one of the few times we're all able to be together. Should I stop being a coward and just go through with the hard conversation? Or should I accept that sometimes family members won't get on perfectly and walking on eggshells might just have to be the norm? I have a great chosen family and feel very lucky to have some stunning people in my life, and you two always make my week better. Sending lots of love from Cornwall, and don't tell the people but I agree, pasties are just shit empanadas.
Yes, the truth. So I think I just want to say up top that I'm not discounting the possibility of homophobia. I'm absolutely not discounting it. But I guess there would have to be a pretty big gap between what she thinks and feels and her public-facing values. And really, you've got to make a judgment about how likely that is. Is she generally a person who has a public persona, which is very different from what she's like privately? Because if so, then maybe that does play a role. But if that's not a generalized trait of hers, where there is a big gap between public persona and privately held feelings and thoughts and values, then I would maybe say, look more at the specifics of your family dynamics. I think that it is often the case with people who leave whatever context they're in, whether it's a family context or a friendship context, and they move far away, which is sometimes they have an unrealistic expectation of things staying the same. And by that, I mean a sense that like you'll just be as close and you can be as part of people's lives. Whereas the fact is that, you know, people move on, right? And there is a sort of like lack of object permanence, which is when you're not in a context where people can see you, that does have an impact on how much they can, you know, include you with what's going on in their lives. There are ways around that, but that involves developing a practice of communication, which isn't just checking in with people. And it's not just about the odd, like, how are you text? It's about having like real emotionally intimate conversations, which are remote. And a way in which like me and I keep talking about my best friend who got married, but it's just because I love her so goddamn much. But like a way in which me and her do it is we send each other really quite lengthy voice notes, which we call podcasts, where we're just talking through all of our thoughts and feelings and perceptions and what's going on. And the benefit of that is that we don't have to be available at the same time, which is hard, right? It's hard to do even when you live in the same place. And it's really hard to do when you don't live in the same place. And so I wonder if it's about that. I wonder if it's about the fact that like you moved away and you have a partner who you live with, you know, your life is operating in this geographic remove, and the lives of your sisters are as well. And there's an expectation of things being the same without having that kind of emotionally intimate, regular communication that would be the thing that keeps you together. Because yeah, it's not that you're going to feel a certain way and then the emotional intimacy will come. It's actually kind of the other way around. You kind of have to like force that kind of communication. And that's going to be the connective tissue which holds you together. Again, I'm also not discounting the idea that there's like specific problems that your sisters have with you or your sisters have with your partner. I guess I would encourage you to open up a conversation, not with you guys behave these ways, but going, hey, I've been feeling this way. And it might just be that I feel isolated from you guys because of where I live. And you guys are all living in London, but this is the vibe I'm detecting. And opening it up like that. Don't have an expectation that one conversation is going to do it all at once. Sometimes these things are iterative, but the benefit of family is that you are always stuck with each other. So even if one conversation goes very badly, it's highly unlikely, highly, highly unlikely that that's going to be what it is forever. So I'd say give the conversation a go. My gut instinct is that it's about the geographic distance, but there might be other things as well. I don't know. What do you reckon?
I think it's hard. I mean, there could be underlying latent homophobia there. It doesn't matter what she says in public. There's lots of different factors that can add up to make someone more hostile to a person, even if it's not the main factor. It could be your gender. You said you've got your sisters apart from you. So there could also be like a resentment there against like a brother, for whatever reason, and that also plays into maybe the latent homophobia. There could be lots of different things going on that also combine with what might just be she has moved to London and for whatever reason, she doesn't like you very much. Mm. Like that's the thing that happens with family sometimes. Like you're born and you like are forced to get on and then you move away and it might not be fair and you might not have done anything, but she just might have decided that she's like, you don't gel that much like you thought. And all those things could create this hostile environment where she's forced to interact with you out of a place of like relation. And that's making her even worse. And because you haven't been able to discuss it or get it out, just like this resentment's built up and you've done nothing wrong. Like you could have done absolutely nothing wrong. Doesn't mean she won't resent you for whatever reason. You do have to have the conversation. It has to start with a conversation. And I think it should start with a one-on-one conversation, physically together, if you can, phone if not, before a holiday. And it doesn't have to be like, let's go over the X, Y amount of things. I think it just has to be a, look, I don't know if our relationship is like the greatest and I don't know why that is. And I want to open the floor for you to tell me honestly how you feel about me and any resentments you might have. And then you can say stuff that you feel. But I think you need to hear her account first, just so you know what you're really working with and how much that aligns with what you've actually witnessed from her in terms of actions. But this kind of stuff can be totally irrational, like totally irrational. And you might never get to a place where you have like a friendship, but you can get to a place where you're civil and you understand each other. And underneath it all, doesn't mean there's not care for you. It doesn't mean there's not this love for you. Often we have this like sufferance love for relatives that might not have emerged in any other context, but the fact that they're family, but it's still there and it's still important. It just might mean that on an interpersonal level, you're never going to be mates. You're never going to be friends. And that's okay. It's just like, how do you accept that? And how do you get to a place where you have like a friendly relationship? And I think when the pressure's taken off it, to have the sort of like sibling bond that people talk about all the time that you might have with the other siblings, you'll find that it's actually a lot easier for that to come. But it needs to be aired out in the first place, I do think. And I don't want to discount any reasons why she might be feeling this way towards you. Because as I said, it might be a multitude of factors. If you think, it's sometimes easy to pin it down to one, like you saying, I think it might just be homophobia. I don't think it'll be one thing. I think there'll be several different reasons that have come together and things she might not be able to admit to herself without a bit of a prodding. But the first thing is to have that conversation with her. And if you can sense that she's off with you, then she is off with you. But she might not even be able to admit to herself that she's being off with you and that there's something that's built up there until you talk to her about it. And I speak from experience.
I think like one last thing is also have in mind some things you can offer as solutions. So have in mind something like, hey, I was wondering like maybe a way around this is like maybe we can voice note each other, or like maybe we have like a call that we do every week or something like that, right? You can sort of say, so it's not just about identifying and agreeing on what the problem is, because you may identify problems, you may not agree with what the problems are, but you might be able to agree a way forward. And that would be my last piece of advice. Shall we do one more problem?
Yeah, let's do it. Go on, okay. Ash, read it out.
Dear If I Speak, I've recently got back with my ex. The short version is we met nearly 10 years ago and dated casually for a couple of years while seeing other people. We then entered a monogamous long distance relationship, which went on for a few years, culminating in living together for nearly 3. We broke up early 2021 as he wanted to settle and have kids, and I wasn't sure about either. We were also arguing a lot. He is pro-cop and pro-capitalism, and I am anti-both. We got back together about a month ago after seeing each other casually again for a couple of months. We had a long conversation about what went wrong last time and both agreed to work on the interpersonal issues we had had. I've come round to the settling down idea, having reassessed my career and life goals. I'm open to settling down and having kids. The issue is we still argue/debate about our political differences. I've thought about your previous advice with regards to treating each other with respect, and I think we do. We get along well otherwise and enjoy each other's company. Plus, the sex is good. I just find the relitigating of our differences quite tiring. Some background, I'm a 30-year-old guy passionate about my career in science, which hampers settling down in one place, and pretty left-wing. He's 28, does an office job to pay the bills, and is quite family-focused. He's left-wing, but much closer to the centre than me. My dilemma is, can you have a long-term relationship when you disagree on fundamentals of your politics and philosophy? Is there something we are missing to make these differences easier, other than one of us biting our tongue for the rest of our lives? Moya, what do you reckon?
Yeah, why are you with someone where you have different values? Why are you with someone where you broke up once already about different values? You claim that you've changed your mind and you've, you know, compromised. Has he compromised on his stuff? You're already tired now. Imagine how tired you will be X years in with 3 kids running about when you're literally at your most stressed. You're most stressed, you're most exhausted, you're most drained. If you're tired now, how tired will you be then? I just don't think this person is for you. I want to understand what made you get back together with them. why them? Because you haven't written about that. I think that's telling. Like, you've written we had a conversation and agreed to work on the issues, but why did you want to get back with this person so much after dating casually? Is it because you decided you want to settle down? You knew this person would settle down at some point? I don't see this relationship as one that's going to go the distance if you already broke up over fundamental differences. And I don't think it's just the politics. I think you might have different values, and that's more important than having different politics per se, even though those two tend to overlap.
Yeah, I mean, so I obviously am with someone who's politically very, very similar to me. That does not mean that we do not have quite intense political disagreements. For example, the role of the anarchists during the Spanish Civil War. We had a very good disagreement about that on our holiday. So you'll find political differences even when you're similar. And I think that in this case, it isn't actually about the politics, because some people find political differences and kind of hashing them out kind of sexy and exciting. Or other people go, yeah, we're different in these ways, but ultimately we're so aligned on everything else that I can live with these differences. I wonder if you're coming back to this idea of, are our differences in outlook and values and maybe what we want out of life, are they just too big, right? You know, and you're saying that you've come around to the idea of settling down and having kids, but you're also like, well, I've got this career and that makes it really difficult. It sort of sounds to me that that isn't as much of a done deal as you would like it to be. And I think, you know, Moya's right in that what isn't in the dilemma is as telling as what's in it, right? So it's all about the differences between the two of you and all about the incompatibility. Very little about what it is that you have that's holding you together. You know, yes, the sex is good and you get on well, but you know, if you made the decision to get back together, together, then it has to be more than that, right? Because like, can't just be like, you know, good sex and being amiable. And so the fact that those deeper things aren't in there, but there are actually some pretty profound differences which are there for you, it sort of makes me wonder if these things aren't as resolved as maybe you're saying that they are. And that for me is the revealing thing. I'm not saying break up. I'm saying really, really get into it and examine what the differences are.
I'm saying break up. Life is too short. Break up. Break up now. Don't get back into a long thing where 3 years down the line, you decide that your fundamental differences are too much for the second time around. Break up. It's better to be single than be with someone and building a life where in the future, you will look over when the sex has stopped and you've got the kids and you want to go do something and they completely disagree and you all the love has gone and you're not amiable to each other anymore. And you're like, why did we do this? The differences were there from the get-go. Break up now.
Why, when the love is gone, does my heart keep holding on? Great song.
Don't know
great
that
song.
One.
And like
no idea
so
what that one is,
many Motown songs, an emotional truth is contained within. I guess the reason why I'm a bit like, I'm not necessarily saying break up is that I think that relationships aren't static and differences aren't static and differences aren't static, like within the context that you choose to create together. And there's something which like me and my partner have had to navigate in various ways where it's like you come up against something which feels so, so difficult and like irreconcilable at the time. And it's not necessarily that you reconcile it. It's just that all the other aspects of your relationship and what holds you together are so much more than this difference, which may have felt so big and so insurmountable at one point. So it's possible, but you can't do it without really, really examining what those differences are within the context of everything else. And the fact that there was very little on the context of everything else and a lot about the differences, I think that itself is telling a story. But all stories must come to an end, as ours has, or at least this chapter, before the next chapter, which will be next week. Moya, that was an emotional one, but I'm glad it was.
Yeah, I mean, just perpetually down at the moment. What's going on with me, Ash? When will I feel better again? I'm fed up of being emotionally spent.
I don't wanna like be a hostage to fortune, but I just bet you will be next week.
Yeah, maybe. We'll see. Yeah, I'm sure I'll recover. I'm sure I'll rally. There's much to rally about. Just a stressful period, you know. Anyway, maybe I'll send in my own dilemma that we can answer.
You're going to be like, I'm in big trouble. It is me.
I know, I won't reveal who it is. We'll just send it in anonymously and then get you to answer it and see how I feel.
Or maybe you could be like, dear, if I speak, you're the two most beautiful, clever, intelligent, insightful women who've ever existed. Like,
you know full well that if I sent in a dilemma, I'd be so hard on myself.
You'd be like, listen up, you dumb bitch. I got a problem.
Yeah, literally. Anyway, I've been Moylothy McLean. You've been...
a dumb bitch. See you next week.
Aw. Bye.
Bye.